You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we are lucky to have with us this morning Trevor Baumgartner, who is with the International Solidarity Movement. And Trevor recently has returned to Seattle from Palestine, Israel. Trevor, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mike, for opening the space up.
Let me ask, how long were you over there? When did you get back?
I was there, I went there on December 2nd and was there until January 10th. And after that, I was in Brooklyn for 3 weeks, which is another war zone.
Of a different type.
Right.
So how did this whole trip over there come to be?
For me, the interest sprung out of, I had the privilege of being a student teacher in June Jordan's Poetry for the People program at UC Berkeley. And the idea for the program comes out of the idea that language is a carrier of consciousness. And so we look at people from around the world whose languages and voices are being deliberately covered up or misrepresented. So Arab and Arab-American poetry was a big part of the course. In addition to that, I was reading the news a lot and getting a little frustrated because you can't, it's difficult to do much or feel useful. The news is, to me, a very disempowering thing to read. It's not participatory. So I wanted to go to Israel and to Palestine to see where my, the way I say it is that to put my mouth where my money goes. And so I went to be a part of the International Solidarity Movement delegation, and then also I did some work on my own.
All right, and while you were there, you actually had done some articles, some dispatches to a local publication at the State.
Right.
Which I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with. And hopefully we can brush upon some of those here in the next half hour. So what really stands out in your mind from your trip?
Well, some of the things that that I saw and learned that were just that will always be with me definitely is the sense of isolation that is being forced really onto Palestinian people. And as well, I mean, it has to be said that the Israelis are also being completely isolated and isolating themselves. The difference is obviously they're the ones with the power and are enforcing isolation on themselves and Palestinians to a large extent. But the isolation really moves from a very personal place and moves outward, kind of like ripples for many Palestinians as their villages are literally sealed. The Israeli military comes in and dumps big piles of mud and dirt and soil across all the roads into and out of a lot of the rural villages so that people can't get out, really. And then Israel will impose curfews and closures, and a lot of these are shoot-on-site types of curfews where people have 1 hour out of the home. They're allowed out of their homes for 1 hour a day. So it's to the point where in a lot of places for a lot of people, their lives are confined to their homes. And that is an incredible isolation. We went to and met the family of Diab al-Sarawi, who lived in Nablus. Nablus right now is where the Balada refugee camp is. A lot of the news is coming out of this right now where Israel has invaded the refugee camp and is essentially just massacring really defenseless people. It's a pretty serious situation there right now. We were there and we met with the family of Diab al-Sarawi, who had just been assassinated a few days before. And one of the things his wife said to us as we were leaving, she called out for an American. She said, "Where's an American? Bring me an American." And she looked at a friend of mine and myself and just said with tears in her eyes, "How can you let this happen to us? Does anybody in your country know what's happening to us? do you see us? And she repeated, does anybody see us, a few times. And that, to me, was the thing that really had one thing that has affected me so deeply and just really signaled the sense of isolation that people feel. They don't feel like they are being seen at all, because it doesn't make sense that if people see them, then we could send Israel Apache helicopters made by Boeing, or Caterpillar could send them bulldozers and whatnot.
So tell me about some of the other stories that you came across.
a couple of stories that definitely that I wrote and Eat the State published were my first week there. I went out to a refugee camp called Calandia, and Calandia is a place where Israel has expanded the borders of Jerusalem, this concept of Greater Jerusalem. So in last March, they basically confiscated about, I think, 70 square kilometers worth of land, and it pushed their border, the border of Jerusalem, from a place called Al Aram to Calandia. What this does, divided the villages of Calandia and Ram, so that now if you are on the Calandia side, which is to say you're out of Jerusalem now, you don't have the right to go to Ram, where maybe your family lives, or maybe there's a store or something like that. So there's a big checkpoint there, which is very developed now. It developed a lot while I was there. Which is to say, there's a huge fence, cement blocks, and dividers for lanes of traffic, and of course, two soldier sniper outposts, and numerous soldiers with jeeps and access for tanks and armored personnel carriers. So I went there to monitor the situation, to intervene when soldiers would get physical with usually the men who are trying to get in or out, or when they're harassing people coming in or coming out. And internationals there, especially with video cameras, or I had some radio equipment there, do have an impact, and it's not always noticeable to us, but the impact is, and that's a positive thing, because if we're not seeing things, then that's obviously the goal. Seeing things meaning seeing people get hooded and put into a tent and interrogated for a few hours or something like that, which happens very frequently at Calandia and other checkpoints. So I went there to interview people, intervene, to just be a physical presence and a noticeable physical presence there. And it was there on the first day when I noticed that when soldiers get bored, or when the situation is kind of mellow, then something has to happen. The soldiers are usually, they're all young men, 18, 19 years old, and a lot of them are at the checkpoints are serving their compulsory military service, which everybody in Israel has to serve. So people get antsy and restless, and then also Palestinians from the village, from Calandia, sometimes young boys will come out and throw stones, and it varies from day to day who starts what, but one thing is very clear, is that it's all started because there is an occupation of their land. At any rate, I was out there and watched the three soldiers climb over a fence and into Calandia, which is out of the area that even Israel recognizes as their sovereign territory. They were now out of the borders of Jerusalem into a Palestinian area. And they started shooting they were shooting rubber bullets and tear gas at young boys. There's about 15 boys who were 12, 13, 14 years old. And I went down towards it all. Again, to be an international presence there, maybe see if they recognize that internationals are there, that they would, they being the soldiers, would mellow out and go back over their fence and back into back to the checkpoint. And that didn't happen initially. I was standing and I was I was pretty well cornered behind a car and in between a little shop, and the soldiers looked at me and shot rubber bullets at me and tear gas, and when the tear gas came, I had to get out from behind this spot, and I was pretty exposed, and this young boy came and grabbed me and took me behind another car, so that I wasn't just a sitting duck, which I was very thankful for, obviously. And then we were ducking behind this car, and the soldiers started firing on the cars that were parked. And as we looked through the window up at the soldiers, the soldiers shot out the window that we were looking through, and this young boy was hit in the face with, I think it was a rubber bullet. I'm just under that assumption, because he staggered off basically under his own power, and he was, you know, obviously he hit in the face. There was blood around, and some of his friends grabbed him and kind of helped him to get into a cab that was waiting there. The taxi driver had opened up his door and was signaling to get him there. So they got him in to the cab, and they drove off. And I was just standing there with a rock in my gut. And some boys came up and wanted to put a rock in my hand after seeing that, which, although I really, at that moment, wanted to throw something. I felt like that wouldn't be a good, necessarily a positive development at this point. Anyway, so instead of heaving a stone, I walked up to the soldiers, in between them and the young boys, and just stood in front of their guns and just talked to them and yelled at them and got out a lot of my frustration and anger, and then we talked for a little bit. And it's very weird to be diplomatic in the middle of, really, like, there are stones falling all around us and stuff. So we talked a little bit, and you know, it gradually became clear that I wasn't going to leave until they did, and so they did, and they told me to talk to the boys too and make them stop throwing rocks, which I certainly had and have some moral problems with something like that, like watching after watching their friend get shot in the face. Like, who am I to tell them how to resist, whether or not that method of resistance is effective in that moment? So anyway, I did. I went out, you know, and I yelled out to some of the boys that if they stopped throwing stones, the soldiers would leave. And some of them listened and waved, but they kept throwing stones, and the soldiers weren't able to make it to their jeep to get away. So they came back over the fence, and the shooting resumed, and the stone throwing resumed, and I felt like there was nothing else I could do, nothing positive that I could do there. The soldiers weren't going to listen to me anymore, and I couldn't communicate with the boys, at any rate. So it was at that point that I left, and then went to a very surreal Peace Now demonstration, which was I don't know which was worse, actually. Seeing the boy get shot in the face, or listening to basically liberal Zionists talk about what the solutions to the problems are.
We were talking about before we went live the kind of the surreal nature of of the ups and downs that, that you saw while you were there, and you were saying that that's pretty much life is, that's a normal life there now, the how you can go from these highs to these lows in a matter of, what, minutes, hours?
Yeah, it usually comes on of a sudden. Like, there's one day we were out at in a town called a village, sorry, called Hares, which is in the Salfit region near Nablus, and we had been there. We were going on a tour through the region, getting an idea of what it's like in the Salfit region, which is a rural area, and it's 20. There are 21 Palestinian villages, kind of in the valley, and they're surrounded by 21 Israeli settlements up top. All the settlements are up on top. So we were getting a tour through the valleys, and it was very, like, the landscape, the geography is very stunning, and it was really beautiful to see these olive trees that were there that were really just breaking through the earth. And it's really one of the most amazing things. People would tell me that you can actually... you can tell when the olive trees were planted, or you can at least tell if they were planted during the Roman era by the distance between them and the different patterns that they're planted in, which to me is amazing. We're talking, I mean, trees that are really thousands of years old that are all right there. And so we're seeing all of this, and then we were taken down to the valley floor and to what was called and is a settlement wastewater treatment facility, which in reality was nothing more than an open stream of raw sewage pouring into a stream. and so we're surrounded by this incredible natural and, like, miracle to me. I mean, it's a very miraculous setting. And then right in the middle of it, literally, is raw waste that's pouring down into the valley floor. And our guide for the day, Nusfet, told me, he said, for 15 years it's been like this. They pour sewage into our streams. They poisoned our water supply. They poisoned the water table, poisoned our citrus groves. And now their sheep and goats don't eat now. And they said that's the way it was. So we went from kind of being stunned by the landscape in a positive way to being very stunned. And I mean, this was something that, like, definitely I couldn't, it was difficult to watch, like, very physically difficult to see. And then after that, we went to Hares, and in Hares, people just came from their houses all over and were bringing us hot, like, homemade pita bread with za'atar on it. And za'atar is this herb mixture in olive oil and homemade hummus. And people are bringing all this stuff out, and people are bringing tea out to us. And we're just having this exchange with all these people. And it was really quite incredible. And then, in 10 or 15 minutes, a group of soldiers came up and declared the area a closed military zone, and soldiers were, like, creeping around in the olive trees there with their M16s, supplied by us, by the way, at the ready. We were forced to leave the Hares. And so this is in the space of a couple hours that we had seen all of this. And these are some very incredible highs and lows that are very difficult to deal with, just on an emotional level. It's hard to have normal emotional reactions that are so intense so many times each day. And this is coming from me, who is basically a tourist. And we were called by this right-wing Israeli newspaper we were called terror tourists. It's hard, you know, not being a part of life there on a permanent basis. It's hard enough to see it. I really can't imagine what it's like to live in that situation.
One of the lines from one of your articles that really struck me was moments of safety or sanctuary come infrequently in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very true. I mean, that was the thing that I noticed. Even in Jerusalem, which is supposed to be a safe, I mean, people say it's kind of like, Jerusalem is where all the journalists hang out. So you know what Jerusalem is like. It's pretty safe place. But at the same time, there's an incredible military presence there and a police presence like nothing I've ever seen. And you can be stopped. Anybody can be stopped at any point. And I was stopped quite a few times there by soldiers and made to show what was in my bag or whatnot. And also, it has to be said that in Jerusalem, there is a very palpable and tangible fear and uncertainty there that people live with, Israelis and Palestinians as well, because that's kind of like it's the economic center for Israel. Which is definitely problematic, and as such, it's targeted a lot by people, you know, who unfortunately would blow themselves up, and that's what. So, actually, as I was flying in, the day I was flying in, December 2nd there was a double suicide bombing in Jerusalem in the touristy area of it. And that's the thing, it's like nobody knows anything, everything is uncertain there, and so by default the only thing you can count on is that the occupation will continues. That's a very hard thing to realize and know, that that's the only thing that you know really for any certainty, with any certainty, is that you will see soldiers.
So what are some of the lessons? What are the things that you're trying to do since you've gotten back?
Well, this is the very clear call from most Palestinians that I met, like such as Diab al-Sarawi's wife, saying, does anybody see us? Most of the Palestinians will... really are very clear that they want us from the United States or from Britain or France or Italy, which is where a lot of the folks that I met, the international folks, were from. They want us to go back and talk to people and tell people what's happening. So for me, that's what I'm really trying to do, is spread the word and also encourage people to go, because once you've gone, for me anyway, it's having been there, everything for me has changed quite literally. I was born here in Seattle, and I'm very familiar with the city, but I see it all very differently now. It has changed my perspective and really my worldview, and it's with that being in the situation where you're like an active participant in history. There's a woman and a writer named Joanna Cotty, who's a Lebanese American writer, and she says that it is your birthright to participate in history. And it's something I really that I really believe in, that to go and to see and to experience that, just it opens up perspectives, and with that opening, what falls away is rhetoric and a lot of just basic, bland analysis. You get what you can't read about, I guess is what I'm trying to say, in a lot of ways. And so I'm really trying to, trying to encourage people to go, encourage people to support people who are thinking about going. And because for me, it was a big, it was a community effort to get me there, as I don't have an income. And so I really relied on the support of the people in my community. Incidentally, I found out a lot about who's in my community, before and while I was there as well.
So you kind of both learned more about Palestine and Israel as well as your own community.
Well, yeah, for sure. You know, I learned about who's here and who is a part of who's a part of my own life, who I am participating in this life with and next to, and that was a very incredible thing, something that's really changed a lot of things for me too, as far as the way I think about myself here in Seattle. But then being there, also meeting all these people. I here's a short story. Was we were in this big march in Bethlehem to the checkpoint in Bethlehem. The goal was to march through the checkpoint and into Jerusalem, and we were calling for religious freedom and respect for all religions. And somebody, well, I met this Belgian guy named Sergio, walked up to me. And I'm sorry, his name is Samir. He walked up to me and he had his cell phone out, and he said, somebody's on the phone for you. And I thought that was very strange because I didn't know anybody there really. And so I picked up the phone, and it was this woman who's a friend of Linda Beavis, who lives here in Seattle, and who Linda had stayed with and met, and when they were neighbors when Linda was lived in Ramallah. And the woman just is like, Linda told me that you were here, and I started making phone calls, and I called all around, and I finally have found you, and I want you to come to my house for dinner, and we want you to stay with us. And this is in the middle of this march. There are 1,500 people in this march, which is very big for Bethlehem. And so it's like, here's somebody who really went very far out of her way to open up her home to me. And then as I was there, she was very insistent that I come back. And the reason being because she said, I you are my son now. And we had, I just had these, it was privileged enough to make these connections with Lutfia and her daughter, Horia, who's 12. And we spent a morning painting pictures, and the day I left, it was snowing in Ramallah, and so we went out and played in the snow. And it's these kinds of connections that that for me are very important, and have like I said, opened up a lot of the different ways that I see things here.
All right. Well, we just have a couple minutes left. Do you have some contact info for any of the groups you've worked with? Or?
Yeah, for sure. There, I just like to say that the International Solidarity Movement, which is who for 2 weeks I was there with in December, they're having another campaign, which is starting the end of March, early April. The 2 week campaigns, and it's direct action, direct support, a wide range of activities, and anybody's interested in going, I strongly encourage it. You can check out, if you have web access, go to www.rapprochement.org. And rapprochement is spelled the French way, rapprochement.org. Definitely go there. You can register for the campaign. You can find out more about it. And you can go to www.palsolidarity.org. There are two websites where you can find out a lot about international possibilities there. If you're interested in doing internships or something like that, there's a couple organizations you check out too. www.grassrootsonline.org. They're based in Boston. They do a lot of intern exchange programs in Dahisha refugee camp and with the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Group and various other Palestinian NGOs, and also the Middle East Children's Alliance down in based in Berkeley, run by Barbara Lubin, who's an incredible voice. She's a Jewish American woman way out front on this stuff. You check out Middle East Children's Alliance. I think it's MECAforPeace.org, MeccaForPeace.org.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time, so I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Well, thank you again, Mike, for opening it up.
You bet. Just been talking with Trevor Bumgarner, who is with the International Solidarity Movement and local Seattle citizen.